This episode of Basel Podcast is sponsored by Kisco Labs. In office work, we realized how important it is to have an ergonomic chair. A crappy chair can destroy your productivity and, in the long run, even your health. We've understood this to be true with chairs, yet not with the IT systems that we use. Many of our IT systems are still crappy, and their negative impact on our work is huge. Kisco Labs has implemented solutions that save up to 50% of work time by redesigning the IT systems. Don't accept crappy IT ergonomics. It's bad for your health. Instead, contact Kisco Labs. The link is in the show notes. I think it's fair to say I'm more worried about privacy on the internet than most people in my social circles. In my opinion, Google makes awesome services. Facebook is great in many ways. But the problem that I see is that we pay for these services with our data. So free is not really free. I hope this doesn't come as a surprise to anyone. So I'd love to pay for these services with money instead of my data, but at the moment, that's just not possible. People saying that I don't care that they have my data probably just don't understand the ramifications. So as Edward Snowden pointed out, not standing up for the right to privacy is basically equivalent to saying we don't need freedom of speech because I have nothing to say. In my opinion, privacy should be a basic human right. If I'm concerned about privacy, my guest today is probably 10 times more so. Ural is an activist, a designer, and a software developer. He's one of the founders of Indie, a tiny social enterprise working for social justice in the digital age. He's also the man behind the Ethical Design Manifesto. We talk about Ural's view on the evolution of computing, current business models of cloud services and venture capital. We cover the Ethical Design Manifesto and its implications on the software we build. This is perhaps not the lightest or the cheeriest episode of Basel Podcast, but hopefully it's thought-provoking. So, enjoy.
My name is Ural Balkan, and I started making things with computers when I was 7 years old. So I got an IBM PC, a compatible computer, when I was seven. This was the end of the 80s, and my dad just brought it home, put it in front of me. I was very lucky. I was very privileged. And it had a basic manual with it. Yeah. And he said a very important thing to me. He said, play with it. You can't break it. And I did. Yeah, I did. Yeah, it took a few years, but I did break it. I broke it by putting in a chip that he had expressly told me not to put in because we had gone to Singapore. We bought this math coprocessor back then, and it was all about speed back then. It was all about features because, you know, I call it the age of features. You know, the personal computer era, that was the age of features. That was where if you had a faster CPU, you could do things that you couldn't do before that were impossible. And that explains the rise of Microsoft and commodity computing, etc. back then in the personal computer era. But anyway, so he got me this computer. And I started making games for it because IBMs didn't have a lot of games back then. You know, Commodore 64s did and Sinclair Spectrums did and Amigas, you know, but I didn't have one of those. So I started making my own games. And I remember the magic of that. I mean, there is something magical about being 7 years old and being able to create a universe for yourself. You know, if that's just little pixels that are stars in your imagination, and if you have a little spaceship that you can build, that you can navigate through it and you're seven, that's magical. And what was different, though, back then was it was the last time in the history of technology as we know it, you know, up until modern day, where our devices worked for us, and that was it. Personal computers were the age of personal computing with PCs. That was the last time when we had decentralized technology. You bought a personal computer and it was a tool for you. It didn't spy on you. It didn't do anything untoward. It was just something that you could explore. You could make beautiful things with. And the things that you made did just what they said they did as well. And ironically, if you look at it, the next evolution of technology was the with the rise of the internet, which is decentralized, the invent of the web, the World Wide Web. And, you know, we all think that, hey, the web, that's decentralized, right? No. The web is centralized. So we went from decentralized technology, personal computers, devices that we owned and controlled and that worked for us, to the web, which in its philosophy, with Tim Berners-Lee when he first created it, was his philosophy was to create a decentralized universal network, which is what we have in the internet. But its architecture, its client and server, and the servers are the center. So its architecture was always one that favored centralization. And we took this and we put it into this enzymatic vat of capitalism, where we took instruments like venture capital and said, hey, let's invest in 10 companies, 5 million each, knowing 9 of them are going to go out of business, but the one we need it to be a $1 billion business. So these businesses have to scale up as quickly as possible. And that meant that those servers had to scale up and the centers had to scale up. And that's what we've seen with Google, with Facebook. We've seen those centers grow, scale vertically and coalesce through purchases. And we have the monopolies that we have today. So, you know, when I got into this, it was a very different world. Our technology worked for us. And, you know, the reason I do what I do today is I want to know how we can go forward to that again, not back. You know, we can't go back to some mythical time. But what is the next web? And that's going to be a decentralized one. Think of it as a pendulum. We start with mainframe computers, which are centralized, but they're, you know, not very common. They're in large organizations like universities, etc., and you have to rent time on them with terminals. That's centralized. Then we got decentralization through personal computers, right? 1976, the Apple, etc., personal computers. And then we went back to a centralized system with the web today, with these platform monopolies. If you think of Google and Facebook, think of them as the mainframes that we had in the past. So we've kind of gone back to a centralized system. So what really interests me, and which is what we're doing and what we're part of the movement, is the next swing of that pendulum, where we're going towards a decentralized system again. But this time in a networked world, in a world that has the internet. That's what's so exciting. And that's why I do what I do, because I want to be a part of that. And I think it's essential for the future of our species.
So why do you feel that being decentralized is so important?
It's important because you as an individual in a decentralized system have ownership and control. And the question there is, of course, ownership and control of what? And in essence, what we're talking about is ownership and control of yourself. If we think about the role of technology today in modern life, what is your phone? Is your phone an assistant? Because we're talking a lot about assistants and now intelligent assistants with artificial intelligence. Is it an assistant? When you have a thought and you want to store that somewhere other than your brain, your biological brain, and you store it on your phone. Now, is that because of a conversation you've had with your phone? Do you say to your phone, hey, phone, would you please store this thought, you know, in your notes application? And your phone says, yes, sure, Aral, I'll do that, of course. If that's our interaction, if that's our interaction with technology, then that is two actors having a conversation, right? And in this scenario, surveillance becomes signals capture between two actors, which is what surveillance always has been. But is this the nature of our relationship with technology? Or is it different? When I have a thought and I want to store it not in my brain, but I want to store it somewhere else on my phone, what if what I'm doing is I'm expanding my mind to my phone? What if I'm expanding my brain, extending myself to my phone, that I'm extending my biological capabilities using technology? In that case, that's a very different relationship. That means that we have to actually extend the boundaries of the self as we see it beyond our physical boundaries to encompass, to include the technologies by which we extend ourselves. In which case, something like surveillance, for example, becomes something completely different. It becomes an assault on the self. And we have a system of justice and laws where we know how to protect the self. We have human rights. So that's why it's so important to decentralize. When we talk about decentralizing, we're talking about taking your data, which is, if we're talking about data about people, we're talking about personal data. Data about people, if you have enough of it, is people. You know, when we talk about profiles, these are not pieces of paper in a manila envelope somewhere. We're talking about living, breathing simulations, right? Which we're analyzing with algorithms constantly, hundreds of algorithms on Facebook, analyzing your every behavior, trying to build a simulation of you. Who are you? That's what they want to know. That's so valuable, right? And the thing is, do they own that? Does Facebook and Google own your digital self? Or do you?
Are you basically saying that like the devices have become extensions of ourselves? The problem is that we no longer own those extensions. They
exactly.
are owned by corporations.
Which by definition then means that we no longer own ourselves. Look at the world we're heading towards. What does it mean if we're heading towards a world where these corporations own our simulations instead of ourselves owning our simulations? We call them profiles today. I like to refer to them as simulations. You know, we're talking about a new type of slavery. Slavery 1.0 was owning people's bodies. And this was a very lucrative business, right? And it was legal. Remember, it was also legal. It was actually shown as one of the main case studies for why the deregulated slave trade was such a big hit. You know, the first people who were celebrating slavery in the sense that we know it were laissez-faire capitalists. They were saying, this is great because we're so much more efficient than when the state was doing it, you know? So that was slavery 1.0, though. Today, when we look back at that, you know, we're like, oh, that's very, you know, that nobody is going to support that in polite company today, right? Even though, unfortunately, there are still over 40 million actual slaves in the world, you know? So it still exists, but it's not legal, yeah. Which is a very big difference. But what is slavery 2.0? You know, what I call people farming, the business model of these companies like Google and Facebook, it is to own and control everything else about you that makes you who you are, apart from your physical self, apart from your physical body. We don't want your physical body anymore. You know, it's cumbersome. It's rude. We don't want that. Everything else about you, though, that's fair game.
So how convinced are you that this is what's going on? Because, I mean, I actually just looked it up on Wikipedia, and
right.
Wikipedia tells me that, like, Google's code of conduct still says, don't be evil.
Well, actually, that page is outdated then, because Google expressly removed that several years ago. And Eric Schmidt, for example, has always been very honest and open about his disdain for how meaningless that term is. But they actually removed that, which is very telling, you know. So that page needs updating for one thing. But we don't need to, I mean, you know, looking at their public relations is one thing and the narratives that they put out is one thing. But to really understand what they do, all we need to do is look at their financial statements and their end of year statements and their statements to their shareholders. What is their business model? So we don't need any, you know, you don't need the complexity of conspiracy theories when you have the simplicity of business models. Just follow the money. How do they make money? For Google and Facebook, it's by farming people. They are factory farms for human beings. And the evidence that you need for that is in their end of year statements.
And one of the things that you're also doing is you're trying to influence the people who are actually making and designing these services through
yes.
the ethical design manifesto.
Yes.
So can you talk a little about that? What's the ethical design manifesto?
Sure. It's very, very simple. At its core, it's about one thing, and that is respect. Respect for human rights. We don't stop there, though. That is the core, but we don't stop there. We also have to respect human effort, and we don't stop there. We have to respect human experience. So what does it mean to have the core of the products that we build respect human rights? It means that the systems that we build, the products that we build, have to be free and open source. They have to be decentralized, interoperable with each other, so there's no lock-in. So decentralized so that we give people ownership and control, of course, of them. And we have to make them very convenient and beautiful everyday things. That's really important. So that's where respect for effort comes in, of course. The things have to be convenient for people to use. And respect for experience, well, let's go beyond all of that and create, you know, things that are amusing and delightful and make people's lives better. We do that, then we start creating viable alternatives to the mainstream. We start creating things that do just what they say they do. If it's a map, it is just a map. It's not a map that also tracks where you're going.
Yeah. And I think one of the problems with this field at the moment is that you can basically only pick one. You can either get like secure, privacy aware products.
Yeah.
Or you can get like a convenient, well-designed product, but you can't get both because I think most of the security aware products are really crappy from a user experience perspective.
And there's a reason for that, because it is not the current mission of the groups that are creating those products to create convenient everyday things. If we're talking about the free and open source community, for example, we're talking about a community that at its heart is a community of enthusiasts. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you are an enthusiast and you're building products for yourself, which is what the free and open source community does, again, nothing wrong with that. But it's like having a hobby in a sense, right? So we're building classic cars because we love classic cars and we love building them. The process of building them is not a chore. That's what we love. So we take, you know, the body of the car and then we find the right engine for us and we know the differences in the engines and we can switch the engines out. And the problem is we're only building these classic cars and then we expect everyone to drive these classic cars to the market and to work every day. When we ourselves probably don't drive those classic cars to the market or to work or at work, but we have them and we love working on them. And the difference there is, you know, if your classic car breaks down, you're happy because you get to spend the weekend working on something that you love.
Yeah.
If the car that you drive to the market or to work every day breaks down, you are very, very unhappy because you just want that to work. And what we're doing, the problem in the free and open source community is we're building these classic cars and we expect everyone to jump through the hurdles of learning how to build them, how to change the engines, etc., and then to drive it to work and to the market. That's not going to happen. It doesn't mean that we're not building great classic cars. We are, but we're not solving the problem of how do we build convenient, beautiful, everyday things that happen to be private, that happen to respect your human rights. But we can't compete on those ideologies. We must compete on the experience.
I guess you could say that Apple's business model is not about data. They actually sell real products. They sell computers and they sell phones. So what do you think about that? Is that any better?
Yeah, well, I mean, several things. I mean, just at the very core, UX. UX stands for user experience. And that's a term that applies to Silicon Valley for what they do, but doesn't apply to what we do, for example, when I talk about ethical design, because we don't use the term user. There are only two industries that use the term user. One is us, as in Silicon Valley, and the other is drug dealers. And it's no coincidence. It's true. And it's no coincidence that one of the main focal points of so-called design, Silicon Valley design, which I call decoration, is to create addictive user experiences. In fact, there's a book on this by Nir Eyal. It's called Hooked, How to Create Addictive User Experiences. And it's very, very popular in Silicon Valley. So I reject that term, user. Let's call people people, because it makes it harder to do bad things to them as well if we actually recognize that they're people. It's a very small step from user to dumb user because it's the other. And it's very easy to dehumanize the other when you use a term like that. But to get back to your original question, Apple has a completely different business model.
Yeah.
180 degrees, right? Apple makes its money by selling you the phone, the iPad, selling you a Mac at a price that makes them very happy. So the moment Apple sells you an iPhone, they're happy at that point. That was their goal. They have achieved their goal. When Google sells you a phone, they're not happy at that point. All of the investment they put into making that possible is not paid back by when they sell you the phone. If you take that phone and you put it in a drawer somewhere, they're very unhappy with you. The moment you start using that phone and they can start tracking what you're doing and storing your information and understanding you better, that's their business model, to sell that value that they get from that insight. That's when they're happy. So that is 180 degrees different from what Apple does. And it's very interesting because for Apple, privacy then becomes an absolute competitive advantage. It is something that they can compete in without breaking a sweat, which would put their main competitor out of business if they try to compete on actual privacy, not the illusion of privacy, which they do very well, you know, with their cute little doodles and, oh my gosh, we're so cute. How could we possibly be evil? Love us, right? If they actually try to compete on privacy, they would go bankrupt because it's completely contrary to how they make their money. So, you know, you don't have to love Apple or agree with everything that they do. And I don't think Apple is a long-term solution in terms of, you know, platforms that protect our human rights, because it's still a proprietary closed system. But they have an absolute competitive advantage in privacy. And they can still throw that away. They can be very stupid, but I don't think they're very stupid.
I guess one argument would also be that, like, that the fact that we have such good services like Google and Facebook, that mm-hmm. that is due to the fact that they've been able to develop the services with our data, and without the data, they wouldn't have been able to come up with these solutions. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, that also is not entirely true. I mean, again, when we talk about data, it's such an encompassing term. It's very important that we make a distinction between data about rocks and data about human beings. So if we're talking about data about rocks, which could include, for example, you know, mapping data, satellite data, etc., there's a whole conversation there to be had about whether that should actually be in the commons, whether that should be owned by all of us. And what does it mean, for example, when Google buys the mapping information from the UK government that was paid for by people's taxes and then closes it off, and then that becomes private property for Google? But that's data about rocks, right? And I think what we're more concerned about right now is data about people. Sure. And that's where that argument breaks down the most, in a sense, because Google doesn't need to know about everyone in order to know you better, right? So for me to know, for example, for me to tell you, it will take you so long to get from your home to your workplace. I need to know where your home is. I need to know where your workplace is. And I need to know the current traffic conditions. Now, two of those things are data about you. One is data about rocks, right? The traffic conditions is data that probably should, again, be in the commons that I can tap into and anyone can tap into. But to give you your personalized recommendation, I just need to know where you live and where you work. I don't also need to know where everyone else in the world lives and works. And that's a very important distinction, because that means that I don't actually have to know where you live and work. Your own device could know where you live and work and then give you the same recommendation without me, without Google, without anyone else knowing that. Those are the alternatives that we need to be building, that we must build. And in that case, it's something very different. It's not a corporation getting smarter about you and learning more about you. It's you learning more about you. And that's okay. As Melvin Kranzberg says, technology is neither good nor bad, nor is it neutral. How we build it and the interests behind it and the business models behind it that create those interests are key here.
I think one of the problems with coming up with like decentralized alternatives for let's say Facebook is that there's no money to be made in the same way as there is with Facebook. That's one of the things that's probably stopping that from happening. Do you feel the same way?
Well, I think there are three statements there. So one is about funding and funding models. The other is that there's no money to be made, which I would disagree with. There is definitely money to be made. And then the third part of the statement is in the same way as Facebook, which I completely agree with. Yes, we cannot fund these alternatives in the same way. We cannot expect them to scale in the same way, because they don't scale vertically. They scale horizontally. And we cannot judge them by the same success criteria. So what we have in Silicon Valley is kind of like Vegas-style gambling, right? A venture capitalist goes at a table, finds 10 startups, puts $5 million on each one of them, knowing that 9 of them are going to go bankrupt. And he or she needs that 10th one to be that billion-dollar unicorn. And we know that there is pretty much one business model where that's possible, that sort of growth, and it's people farming. It's selling people. And again, slavery was good business too, right? Remember? And remember at the start of the Industrial Revolution, we were doing the same thing with just despoiling the environment at a rate never before seen, digging into it and destroying trees, et cetera, until at one point we started going, well, if we keep at this rate, it's great business, you know, but we're not going to be able to have air left to breathe. So it's the same here. It's kind of like we're at the start of the Industrial Revolution, you know? And what we're doing is we're farming people, and we're kind of only now getting to the point where we're going, should we be farming people? So I think it's very, very important that we judge these alternatives by a different set of criteria, and we need to fund them. We can't fund them with venture capital. Venture capital doesn't invest in long-term sustainable businesses. Venture capital invests not in the business itself, but on the exit. They invest in the sale of the business. And so with startups, we're creating these disposable businesses. So maybe we need to start thinking about not building startups, but maybe stay-ups. You know, these sustainable long-term businesses. Then how do we fund those? Not with VC, not with equity capital. Maybe in the short term with share of revenue, share of profit. Why don't investors benefit when a business is successful and is getting more successful in the long term? Why don't they benefit from that? Why do they benefit from the sale? It's a failure of imagination that we're not even exploring this. But then longer term, we also need to ask ourselves, how much of what we're building is infrastructure? How much of it is for the common good? You know, how much of the systems that we're building are our new roads, our new pavements, our new parks? Because they are. A lot of these are. But they're all shopping malls today. They're all privately owned. And one of the things about a shopping mall is you don't have any rights there apart from the rights that the property owner gives you. You don't have any free speech rights in a shopping mall. If I own a mall and you're walking around in my mall wearing a t-shirt I don't like, I can chuck you out. You have no free speech rights. So maybe if we decide that those things are important for us, that we need some of this to be in the commons, we fund it from the commons. We use taxes to build roads. We use taxes to build sidewalks. Why don't we fund a technology commons? Maybe one in Europe. We can do things differently to Silicon Valley. We don't have to worship at their altar. Yes, they do things a certain way, but we also see how toxic that can be for things that maybe we value more here. So why don't we build a technology commons here? Why don't we support from the commons the core infrastructure of a peer-to-peer network where people will have ownership and control over their own space on the internet? And then all your devices, your Internet of Things, etc., can connect to your always-on encrypted node, for example, a peer network. This is entirely feasible. We just need a little bit of imagination, and we need to stop worshiping at the altar of Silicon Valley.
What about the practical implementation of such a system? Because I think that, like, idealistically, if you think about that, it's very easy to agree with that this would be better, and if Europe could build it, it would be really good.
And it could be used everywhere as well. I'm not talking about a silo.
But we could start it here.
Exactly.
Okay, that's great. But if I look at like the public funded or public IT projects that are ongoing at the moment, it's very hard to believe that such an effort would ever like...
Don't get me wrong. I am in no way advocating that government should build this.
Yeah.
I'm talking about funding this with public funds. Who we get to build it. Well, we decide on, here's how we do it pragmatically, right? We decide on an interoperable protocol where we say, okay, let's say everyone in Europe gets access as a human right to a certain amount of encrypted storage and functionality in a peer-to-peer network, okay? We fund that through taxes at the European level. But the people who build this, it's interoperable. So we get lots of organizations to host these spaces for people. And it's in the commons, it's hosted from the commons. And they can then go beyond this. Now they have this network that is peer-to-peer. They can build value-added services on top of this themselves. They can compete in making the platform better. Because it was funded from the commons, all of that is shared back into the commons, but the services themselves, they can charge for. Individuals can pay for the value-added services on top. And then what do these companies compete on? Quality of service, which is what a company should be competing on. Not on siloing you away, not learning as much about you as possible, on providing you with a service in the best possible way. That's why companies should exist or should exist. So in no way am I talking about governments building this. No. But we can support it from the commons.
What do you think are things that, like, if someone's listening to this now and thinking that okay, this is something that I want to be somehow part of the solution for,
right?
And so, what are some things that people might start doing to help with this issue?
Well, I mean, depending on who you are, depending on what your skill set is, there are lots of things that you can do. I mean, if you don't have technical knowledge, or if this is not your main focal area, you know, don't use Gmail, because there is a convenient alternative in Fastmail. You have to pay them a couple of bucks a year. You know, use Signal. It's actually free and open source and free to download as well. And get your friends to do it. Not everyone has to move to this. Just get your family. Do you want to talk to your family, share pictures of your kids without anyone else looking? Start using Signal and see how you like it, right? If you are in the industry, and let's say you're working at Google or Facebook, and you start realizing, well, maybe you're not very comfortable with what you're doing, because you probably weren't told this, right? You probably weren't told you're being hired to do this. You were told that you're being hired to build things that make the world better. So there are companies that are doing that, companies that sell products, not people. So maybe consider trying to work there if you can. I mean, you have very highly regarded skills in an industry that is very much in demand right now. You can use yourself, you know, if you can move from a company that sells people to a company that sells products, which we have a lot of in Europe, much more than in the US. We have companies that actually just sell a product, and they're not startups. They sometimes call themselves startups, which is very sad, because they're better than startups. Because startup is a Silicon Valley brand, and one which I really think we shouldn't perpetuate. But move to a company that sells a product instead. Actually make the world better, and that's it. Don't contribute to the system where you're also doing these other things, people farming. That's very important. Spread awareness. You know, we started winning the war against big tobacco when big tobacco started becoming socially unacceptable, and smoking became socially unacceptable. Because remember, 1930s, doctors used to say, please smoke. That's how we're going to win the battle against big data in the same way. And, you know, maybe make that move if you work in such a company. Maybe make that move before you're forced to make that move. Be a trailblazer. Come on. I was speaking to Eric Schmidt at a social event a few years ago, and he said to me, if we become too evil, we won't find anyone to work for us. And I thought it was a very naive thing to say back then, because I was thinking, my gosh, well, you know, Monsanto finds people to work for them. Halliburton finds people to work for them. But what he meant was that they couldn't find the best people, and that's what they need, right? I mean, I was at another conference at one point where there were these two guys and they were hiding their badges. So I was just kidding with them. I was like, hey, I can't see your name. Why are you hiding your badge? And they were like, oh, actually, we really didn't want to show you, you know, where we work. And it was Halliburton. They were ashamed of working at Halliburton. I predict in 5 to 10 years, people are going to be hiding their badges if they work at Google, because people are going to be so aware of what they're doing.
Thanks a lot for your time. It's really interesting.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
You've reached the end of the episode. Thanks for listening. I recently wrote a blog post on my strategy for increased privacy. So, for example, I don't use Google, I use Startpage. I don't use Gmail, I use Fastmail. I use Safari as my main browser, but I've blocked Facebook, Google, and YouTube with an extension. I use Facebook, YouTube, and Google exclusively from Firefox, and I've configured Firefox to remove all history every time it's restarted. If you want to read more about this, you can check out the blog post. The link is in the show notes. There's one more episode of Boss Level coming up before Christmas. So talk to you again in 2 weeks. Bye.